For those of you who are standing, there's still several seats in the back corner there. Feel free during the introduction to shuffle over. Better probably not to stand or move around once the justices are with us. Well, good morning. My name is Anthony Johnstone, and I teach constitutional law down the road at the University of Montana's Blewett School of Law, where even though my office looks out on a large Go Grizz sign, we are honored to serve the bar, bench, and public as Montana's flagship law school. And I myself am proud to come from a family of Bobcats. It's my privilege to welcome you to the Supreme Court's hearing of John Krakauer versus the state of Montana. I want to preview the arguments this morning for you by introducing first the Constitution, then the courts, and then finally some words about this case. A special welcome to all of the students, both university and high school students who are joining us. I'll begin with our Montana Constitution, this document here. In 1972, 100 ordinary Montanans proposed an extraordinary document, the Montana Constitution. After debate and by popular vote, the people of Montana adopted the Constitution by the narrowest of margins in 1972. Its preamble reads, "We, the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of our state, the grandeur of our mountains, the vastness of our rolling plains, and desiring to improve the quality of life, equality of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution." One of our most important constitutional rights is to see our government at work, something we'll see the court at work today. Three branches of government put our Constitution to work, and the officials in each of them are sworn to support it. The legislature, our state senators and representatives, and the people through the initiative who write the laws, including some of the laws at issue here. The executive, our governor, the attorney general, board of regents, other state officials, and local governments, the executive branch enforces the laws through prosecutions, civil actions, and administrative agencies. Finally, the judiciary, the Supreme Court, as well as district courts and other lower local courts, the judiciary applies the law passed by the legislature and enforced by the executive by deciding cases. Now, in Montana, we have two levels of courts, federal and state. Also, seven of our eight tribal nations have tribal courts. The federal courts are led by the Supreme Court of the United States in Washington, D.C. Federal courts generally hear questions arising under the United States Constitution and laws enacted by Congress. The tribal courts generally hear questions arising under tribal constitutions and laws. But most laws are state laws, and most courts are state courts. State laws and courts have by far the greater impact on our lives. In Montana, in our state courts, 1,000 cases are filed per day, hundreds of thousands each year. About half of them are traffic cases, some of them may be yours. Trial judges and juries hear those cases and decide them. At that stage, in the trial courts, lawyers present facts, evidence, through witnesses and documents, and make legal arguments for why their client should win through the application of the law to those facts. The lower courts then decide the case based on the facts and the law and write that decision in an order and judgment. In a few hundred of those cases, one side or the other doesn't agree with the lower court's decision and appeals that case to the Montana Supreme Court. In Montana, nearly half of our appeals involve civil matters like personal injuries or contract disputes, usually between private individuals and businesses. About a third of the appeals involve criminal matters like drug trafficking, thefts, assaults, and homicides. The remaining appeals involve family matters like divorce and disputes over child custody. At the Supreme Court, as you'll see this morning, there are no witnesses testifying to facts, only lawyers arguing the law. Most of these appeals pose the question of whether someone, one of the parties, has followed or violated the law. But a few cases question whether a public official's action itself is legal or constitutional under the Montana Constitution. In other words, if the state government itself violates the higher law of the Constitution, then the law or the official action is invalid because the Constitution comes from we the people and we are the supreme source of law in our land. What does it mean for the government to act unconstitutionally? Well, when we the people formed our state government, we gave the government certain powers and duties, like the power to regulate in the interest of public health and welfare, the power to collect taxes, the power to run public universities like this one. But we also retained certain rights against our government, like the freedom of speech, the right to observe government, and the right to privacy. The Constitution is a deal the people made with their government. In one way, the main way we the people hold our government to the constitutional deal is through elections, when we think the legislature, executive, or courts aren't doing their constitutional duties or respecting our constitutional rights, we can vote them, including the judges in Montana, out of office. But another way, and the way that is at issue here, is by going to court to challenge the laws the legislature passes or the actions a government official takes. Sometimes you go to court as a defendant, raising your constitutional rights, such as when the police accuse you of a crime based on what you think is an unconstitutionally unreasonable search of your car or home, for example. Sometimes you raise your constitutional rights as a plaintiff, bringing a case, such as when the legislature passes a law that you think violates your right to privacy, or when you think a state official has withheld information you think you have a right to know. That's what's happening in this case, and I'll turn to it now. John Krakauer is an author who has written several books, including Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. I hasten to add, despite the provocative title, that Mr. Krakauer has also said that the University of Montana is safer now than most schools, and Missoula is a lot better than most places, something I agree with. In researching his book, Mr. Krakauer investigated several claims of sexual assault brought in both the university disciplinary system and the criminal justice system in state court. There are important differences between the two proceedings. The campus proceedings can begin with a student complaint and are held confidentially while the university determines whether to discipline a student by suspension or expulsion. The court proceedings, on the other hand, must begin with a finding of probable cause to commence a prosecution. They have to ask a judge permission to bring the case, and they're held publicly while the judge and the jury determines whether to convict an accused person of a crime and possibly sentence him to prison. One of the claims Mr. Krakauer investigated involved a student who was found not guilty of sexual assault in a criminal trial. The student also was subject to university disciplinary proceedings on campus, according to Mr. Krakauer. He reported that those campus disciplinary proceedings found that the student committed sexual assault and that those proceedings recommended his expulsion from the university. Mr. Krakauer also reported that the Commissioner of Higher Education overturned that decision under university policy. While Mr. Krakauer had various sources for the campus proceedings, he sought additional information about the commissioner's decision. In January 2014, he made a public document request to the commissioner, referring to the student at issue by name. The commissioner denied the request, citing student privacy, and accordingly, without identifying whether those proceedings or documents even involved the named student. In response, Mr. Krakauer filed this case in the state trial court at Helena, seeking to order the commissioner to release the documents. Under the Montana Constitution, our law allows every citizen to inspect and copy public documents subject to the right of individual privacy, and to ask a court to review any refusal by a public official to allow inspection and copying of public documents, such as the ones that Mr. Krakauer requested. Instead of a trial, both sides ask the judge to decide the case based on the law and papers filed in court. In September 2014, District Judge Kathy Seeley in Helena held that Mr. Krakauer was entitled to the documents he requested, and that the student's privacy rights did not require the commissioner to withhold those documents. Both sides have made their arguments in written briefs filed with the court, as have two other interested organizations that each filed briefs with the court as amici curiae, or friends of the court. On one side, the United States government, the Department of Education, sides with the commissioner, arguing that federal law strongly protects student privacy. On the other side, several groups representing journalists side with Mr. Krakauer, arguing that the public has an important right to know how the university system handles sexual assault claims. So the court has read their arguments, and we'll ask the lawyers questions to clarify those arguments in today's hearing to help the justices decide how the case will come out. They'll probably even interrupt the lawyers, which the lawyers will welcome, because the lawyers want to make sure that the justices understand their positions. Again, these are not factual disputes before the court, but legal arguments based on the Montana Constitution and laws. Let's turn to the specifics of the case now and preview some of the arguments you might hear in a few minutes. Section 9 of the Montana Constitution's Declaration of Rights guarantees the right to know. It provides no person, note that there's a difference between the law that says citizen and the Constitution which says person. That's going to come up because, well, Mr. Krakauer most certainly is a person. He is not a citizen of Montana. No person shall be deprived of the right to examine documents or observe the deliberations of all public bodies or agencies of state government and its subdivisions. A right to examine documents and observe deliberations, except, the Constitution says, except in cases in which the demand of individual privacy clearly exceeds the merits of public disclosure. So you have a balancing act. This case is about that last provision and whether the demand of student privacy clearly exceeds the merits of disclosing the commissioner's documents concerning student discipline. The parties disagree on how to balance these two important Montana constitutional rights, the right to know and the right of privacy. Mr. Krakauer argues that the right to know prevails over the right to privacy because the student's case is already well publicized, and the only information left to discover is the commissioner's basis for overturning the student's discipline. He is concerned that if student privacy prevents the disclosure of these documents, then the public will never know how the commissioner handles high-profile sexual assault complaints. The commissioner, on the other hand, argues that the right to privacy prevails over the right to know. Because student privacy is traditionally well guarded by both state and federal law, and that even if the state right to know requires disclosure, federal student privacy law is supreme. The commissioner is concerned that if student disciplinary proceedings can be made public, especially those concerning sexual assault claims, then a student's reputation might be unduly harmed, or some victims or witnesses may be less likely to report serious crimes. The question for the Supreme Court is whether the demand of individual privacy rights clearly exceed the merits of public disclosure for these records. In other words, the court must decide which is more important in this case, making the commissioner's records public or keeping the student's information in those records private. Here the parties disagree even as to the merits of public disclosure. The commissioner argues there is little public benefit to be gained through the disclosure of these disciplinary records because the specific conduct at issue already has been exhaustively explored through witness testimony at a public criminal trial. And general concerns about the handling of sexual assault cases by the university have been addressed through comprehensive investigations conducted by state and federal officials, as well as by Mr. Krakauer's own investigation and published book. Mr. Krakauer responds the story he wants to tell requires an explanation of the commissioner's decision because the criminal charges against a student make it more, not less, important to know why the commissioner did what he did. And the federal and other investigations into the university, as well as related settled agreements to enforce federal education law, give the public reason to know whether and how university officials are complying with that law. Yet this debate about the merits of public disclosure are only one side of the legal balance. To defeat disclosure, privacy must weigh heavily on the other side. There are two primary sources of privacy rights at issue, state and federal law. First, the Montana Constitution provides the right of individual privacy is essential to the well-being of a free society and shall not be infringed without a compelling state interest, the highest possible interest that courts demand of government. This right generally protects Montanans' private information and private choices against government interference, unless the government has a compelling reason to interfere with your privacy. But the right to privacy only extends where a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. For example, we generally have a right to keep our medical information private from government investigations, unless the government has a really good reason, for example, to investigate a crime. Here, the commissioner argues that students reasonably expect their academic records, including disciplinary records involving them, should remain private. The Montana legislature has enacted a law prohibiting the release of student records without the student's consent or a court order. The university's own student conduct code also provides for student confidentiality in disciplinary proceedings, whether the student is an accused, a victim, or a witness. Beyond these policies, the commissioner argues that students generally don't expect their university to disclose potentially embarrassing information about their conduct on or off campus. Mr. Krakauer responds that his primary interest in the disciplinary records is the commissioner's decision, not the student's conduct. To the extent an allegation of sexual assault has been prosecuted in court, the underlying details are already public. And to the extent a student is already a high-profile campus figure, as Mr. Krakauer argues, he should not reasonably expect his conduct on or off campus to remain private. In a second source of privacy rights we'll hear about today, regardless of the Montana Constitution, federal law protects student privacy through the Family, Educational Rights, and Privacy Act of 1974, which I suspect we'll hear referred to today by its nickname, FERPA. Because this is federal law, it trumps any conflicting state law, even our state constitution. This is a result of the Supremacy Clause. Look at that, I have the other one too. Under the U.S. Constitution, the Supremacy Clause says that this constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state, including the judges we'll see up here, are bound thereby, anything in the constitution or laws of a state to the contrary notwithstanding. So federal law controls, state law falls into the background. Though what this means is unclear, because as a matter of federalism, Congress may not have the power to tell universities, especially state universities, what they can and cannot disclose. What Congress does have the power to do is to spend federal funds on education in the forms of grants and federal student loans, and condition a state's receipt of those funds, in Montana, hundreds of millions of dollars in our university system, condition that money on compliance with federal laws like FERPA. That is exactly what Congress did with FERPA, so that the federal government will deny funding to any educational institution which has a policy or practice of releasing private student information. There's a lot of money at stake in that law. However, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that Congress cannot threaten to deny such federal funding in a coercive matter. So we might hear that discussed. Is this application coercive? Under the federal law itself, the commissioner argues that FERPA prohibits disclosure of the student disciplinary records without the student's permission. It's relatively clear that FERPA would prohibit the university's disclosure of records that pertain to an identifiable student. And Mr. Krakauer has identified the student whose records he seeks. What is less clear is whether FERPA defeats a state right-to-know claim for disclosure brought in state court. Though the stakes involved in a potential loss of federal funds to the university system are so high that the university does not want to risk violating that federal law. Here, Mr. Krakauer disagrees with the commissioner in the United States' strong reading of FERPA. He argues that the case-by-case enforcement of Montana Constitution's right-to-know is not the kind of policy or practice of releasing student academic records that FERPA prohibits. In any event, FERPA provides an exception for the release of student information furnished in compliance with a judicial order, which is what Mr. Krakauer is seeking in this case. So that's the background. Now let's get started. Because the commissioner's lawyers will be sitting here, because the commissioner lost in the district court below, he is the appellant, and his lawyer will argue first and last. The commissioner is represented by Viv Hamill of Helena. Mr. Krakauer is the appellee, and his lawyer will argue second. He is represented by Mike Malloy, also of Helena. Chief Justice Mike McGrath will introduce the court. The Supreme Court has 7 members, including the Chief Justice and 6 associate justices. After hearing the arguments, the justices will meet in conference to discuss the case, vote on which side they think the law supports, and assign opinion writing duties. We could expect an opinion anywhere from 2 to 8 months from the date of this hearing. And don't expect anything in the interim giving them a hint as what they're saying, except maybe listen carefully to their questions if you want to know what they're thinking. If the justices are unanimous, there'll be one opinion written by one justice for the whole court. Sometimes they might agree but disagree on the reasons, and there'll be concurrences written by other justices. Sometimes there may be disagreement on the result. One side might think that the commissioner should win. Another side will think that the Mr. Krakauer should win. In that case, whichever side receives four justices' votes will prevail. This is an official judicial proceeding, so please remain silent and seated during the arguments. Turn off your mobile phones and any other devices that may interrupt the proceedings. The clerk of the Supreme Court, Ed Smith, will begin the proceedings shortly. But before that, I would again like to welcome all of the students here. And any interested college or high school student is welcome to stay after the argument right here in this temporary courtroom for a short question and answer session that some of the justices have agreed to provide. We'll do that here about 10 minutes after the arguments conclude. Lawyers aren't invited. But students, by all means, high school students, MSU students, middle school students, please, after the argument, come up here. The justices will be out in about 10 minutes after the arguments conclude. And Chief Justice McGrath said he'd be happy to talk with you and answer any of your questions that he can. He's not going to tell you what he thinks about the case either, though. We'll have to wait for an opinion for that. Thanks to the Montana Supreme Court for sharing these important proceedings with us here in Bozeman, and thanks to all of you for joining us here today.
This is time for the oral argument in cause number 150502, entitled Krakauer versus Commissioner of Higher Education. I'm Mike McGrath, Chief Justice, and let me take a moment to introduce members of the court. For those of you who don't know all the court members, on this end is the Honorable Justice Jim Rice. We have the Honorable Justice Jim Shea, the Honorable Justice Lori McKinnon, the Honorable Justice Mike Wheat, the Honorable Justice Beth Baker, and sitting in today in place of Pat Cotter, we have District Court Judge John Brown from here in Gallatin County. Counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
Ms. Hamill.
Chief Justice McGrath, Associate Justices of the Court, may it please Your Honors, Viv Hamill representing the Commissioner of Higher Education, Clayton T. Christian, along with Associate Counsel Jessica Brubaker. I hope to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case is here today because protecting the confidentiality of information in the educational records of past and present students is a specific legal duty that the Montana University System, or MUS, is charged with under state and federal law. The educational records in Mr. Krakauer's vast request, documented on pages 3 and 4 of his petition for judicial review, contains personal information not only about the named student, but also about the complainant, student witnesses, student panel members. All those students, including the named student, have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those records. I need to quickly dispel the variety of factual speculation in Mr. Krakauer's arguments. On page 40 of Mr. Krakauer's brief, he asserts that the commissioner's decision was undisputably the final decision in the case, and that it is the only document that hasn't been released. Yet on page 22 of his brief, he asserts that the commissioner reversed and remanded the lower decision. Judge Seeley's balancing analysis was flawed because she relied on Mr. Krakauer's speculation that, one, the only document that hasn't been released is the commissioner's decision, and two, the unsealed file from Judge Christensen's courtroom in 2012 refers to the named student, and three, an erroneous assumption that a student code of conduct record at the University of Montana is identical to the record in Judge Christensen's courtroom in 2012. The MUS has not, and we know of no records that have been released with personally identifiable information regarding the named student. Judge Christensen went to great lengths in his decision to protect the privacy interest of all involved when he unsealed and heavily redacted certain student records in his courtroom in 2012. On page 10 of his decision, he ordered that any identifying information as to those individuals will be redacted in the unsealed case file.
Ms. Hamill, was there was not an in-camera review by the district court in this case of the requested documents, was there?
No, there was not, Your Honor. We came ready, willing, and able, and actually expected that there would be an in-camera review that day or a court date set in the future for in-camera review. Mr. Malloy, on behalf of Mr. Krakauer, didn't exactly oppose in-camera review, but he thought the only purpose for it would be to ensure that the records were properly redacted. That's not why we thought there should be an in-camera review.
So was there a request made and rejected by the court for an in-camera review?
Your Honor, we were there to do it. We wanted an in-camera review, but Mr. Malloy said he didn't think that was necessary, and so the judge didn't order it.
So the documents are not anywhere in the record, correct?
That's correct. I have to point out that even if unredacted records were widely published anywhere, the Montana University system could not talk about those records and release them. College and universities' hands are tied even when documents are readily available in unredacted form elsewhere. This blanket prohibition that all colleges and universities are under is important. And a simple example of why would be someone's sister posts their brother's college suspension letter on Facebook. That doesn't mean that we can now give out that suspension letter to any member of the public who asks for it. The Department of Education Family Policy Compliance Office has said that time and again, if they're available elsewhere, colleges, you still can't give them out. In one of their letters of technical advice that's available on the website was to Cornell University. Cornell University was admonished because a professor had given out student records to a retired professor who asked for them. The professor thought he could do that because those records were in unredacted form down at the local courthouse. The Department of Education said, no, just because they're available elsewhere, college, you can't give them out unless you have the student's consent for those records to be released.
Well, Ms. Hamill, they can also be released pursuant to a court order, can't they?
Your Honor, let me address that issue right now regarding court orders or subpoena. Well, yes, a court order, if it's not appealed, Your Honor, but with respect to court orders or subpoenas that Mr. Malloy has raised in his brief as something he could have simply gotten, to us that's just a red herring issue. Subpoenas cannot be issued with a petition for judicial review as a shortcut that avoids the balancing test. Mr. Krakauer made that argument that he could get a subpoena, then the privacy protections in Article 2, Section 10, and Title 20, Part 25 magically disappear. In civil and criminal cases where student records are needed because the student has information that's germane to a material issue in a case, or the student might be a witness, or the student has exculpatory information, courts around the country look at the nature of the information sought, the relationship between the information and the issue in dispute, and the harm that may result from releasing the information. Two cases that I'll cite that have cases within them from around the country are People of the State of Colorado versus Batchoffer at 192 Pacific 3rd, 454, and People versus Wittrin at 221 Pacific 3rd, 1076. Also, our Rule 45 of the Code of Civil Procedure permits a subpoena to issue only in cases where you're compelling a witness to come to trial or to go to a deposition or to bring documents and come testify. They're not available in a right to know case. The remedy, if we had not appealed Judge Seeley's order and not obeyed the order to release records, would be contempt. It's not a subpoena, Your Honor. The same is true under FERPA with respect to court orders and subpoenas.
You lost me there. You'd be under contempt where? In whose court?
In Judge Seeley's court, if we had not obeyed her order to release records and not appealed.
Okay.
But let's talk about, I think what Justice Sweet was getting at, if I'm not mistaken, is the court order exception. And in your initial response to that, you talked about not avoiding the balancing test. So would you acknowledge that under the court order exception in FERPA, courts have applied a balancing test to determine whether there is need for the requested document and whether it should be provided in that specific case? And I think you did cite the Moak case that applies that balancing test. So would you advocate for such a balancing test in a case like this?
No, I would not, Your Honor, for a variety of reasons. But most importantly, because in this case, if we were to obey the order of Judge Seeley, we would be ignoring the express provisions of FERPA that prohibit us from releasing the records. We think that would become a policy and practice. In ESPN versus Ohio, Your Honor, ESPN argued that, gee, if the university just obeyed the one court order that says hand out the documents in spite of FERPA, it's not a policy or practice. But the United States and the Department of Education argued in that case, and the court agreed, that the court order so turns a blind eye to the mandates of FERPA that it would be a policy and practice for the university to give out those records.
But normally, counsel, when a subpoena is issued, there can be a motion to quash. There can be there is that balancing test that's applied once the subpoena is contested and it goes in front of a judge. So I guess I'm not sure it seems like we're mixing apples and oranges here. The balancing test occurs upon issuance of the court order, isn't that correct?
And Your Honor, it's not the student's right to know versus the student's right to privacy versus the right to know that's part of the balancing test in a subpoena. Are those records germane to a particular third-party case?
Well, I think the way the courts have described the test is whether the party seeking disclosure shows a genuine need that outweighs the student's privacy interest, and that is a significantly heavier burden than in the ordinary discovery situation. So I guess that's the question, whether that sort of balancing test, whether it's looking at the interests of a third party or the party seeking the disclosure, whether that kind of a balancing test would perhaps comport with our Constitution in terms of the balancing tests that we ordinarily apply.
I understand your question, Your Honor. In my mind, there are two different tests. In the right to know case, it's a balancing test of whether the right to know trumps the student's right to privacy. In a third-party subpoena or a court order case, it's whether the student or the student record has information that's material to an issue in that third-party case. To me, they're different, Your Honor. And in a subpoena case...
counsel, which test are you arguing that we apply here today?
Your Honor, I'm arguing that a couple of things. First, that the student privacy laws are strict and the policy reasons behind them require that the balancing test in a right-to-know case is weighed in favor of the student. That's the balancing test I'm talking about. In a subpoena or court order case, the student or their parents actually get notice of the court order or subpoena. There was no subpoena issued in this case.
Okay.
But counsel, so, but doesn't part 20, or excuse me, title 20, part 25 of our own code contemplates the balancing test, doesn't it, when it 511 obligates the university to protect the privacy of the student, but then 515 expressly allows for the subpoena. So are you saying that effectively FERPA preempts our student privacy acts, or at least 515 that would allow for disclosure of the records?
No, I'm not, Your Honor, not at all. And I'll get to that in just a minute, if I could hold off with that answer once I get through the important policy reasons behind 515 and 511, with your permission?
That's fine.
Okay. It is our position today that the Judge Seeley's decision with the significant should balance her decision against the significant policy reasons why there is privacy in student records. There are unparalleled reasons for privacy. Our Montana Student Code of Conduct in 2012 and now promised privacy to all the students involved. We promised it to the witnesses, to the faculty. We promise in our policies then and now that we will abide by state and federal privacy laws. Aside from the specific campus policy reasons, we touched upon the chilling effect on page 30 of our opening brief as to why it's important to keep student disciplinary records and that process confidential. Probably the best way to highlight that is from the hearings in 1990, 92, and 98 when Congress passed the Student Right to Know and Campus Security Act. During those hearings, Congress went over the reasons why student privacy exists, had debate with campus security experts and female students and male students about whether those disciplinary processes should be open and the records open. And each and every time the Congress decided that they should remain closed, that it will have a chilling effect on students testifying.
I want to ask you a question in that regard. Mr. Krakauer in his brief argues that we're not really dealing with the privacy of the student in this case. What we're dealing with is the process itself. And you stated something earlier that FERPA deals with the privacy of the student and the process. Is that your position, that FERPA protects the process as well as the privacy of the student?
Your Honor, there is nothing about that process that doesn't pertain to student educational records. So, yes, it is our position.
Okay, so if a student is involved, and that's all they have to do is be involved, everything. There's an umbrella that protects everything. That's your position?
Yes.
Okay. Ma'am, then when under FERPA would information ever be released?
Your Honor, there are 16 exceptions under FERPA for information being released. And there are five categories of information that are not defined as educational records. Now, our Montana student privacy law in 2025-511 has no exceptions for release of student educational records. And we believe our Montana legislature has spoken clearly when it passed 511 and wrote, it is the legislature's intent that an institution of the university system of Montana is obliged to respect a student's right to privacy. And while 511 has no exceptions within it, 515 has just two exceptions. Those two exceptions are consent and subpoena. And Mr. Krakauer has argued that it's disputed under FERPA whether disciplinary records are educational records. And while we think he's relying on outdated case law for that position, there can be no dispute that our Montana educational student privacy law does cover disciplinary records. 2025-515 starts out talking about academic records that can only be released with a student's consent or a subpoena. But that statute goes on to say, a student's written permission must be obtained before the university or college may release any other kind of record unless such record shall have been subpoenaed by a court or tribunal of competent jurisdiction.
So doesn't counsel, doesn't that provide the mechanism for applying a balancing test, which considers the student's privacy and all of the policy reasons that you've articulated, which can fall under the umbrella of the right to know balancing test as well?
I don't think that statute in and of itself, Justice McKinnon, applies speaks towards a balancing test, but I think the balancing test is there because of Article 2, Section 9, and Title 2 and the right to know statutes. It's our position that the policy reasons behind those student privacy statutes weigh in favor of never opening up those disciplinary records, unless an exception, one of the 16 under FERPA or the two under our law, do apply. Student code of conduct processes are not like a criminal trial. There's no right to counsel. Hearsay is admissible. There's no subpoena power. We keep those processes closed because we want students and student witnesses to be able to testify outside the public spotlight without peer pressure before or after a hearing. And FERPA does specifically define that the privacy interests apply to the student witnesses at a code of conduct hearing. Even in cases, Justice McKinnon, where there's a subpoena issued for a third-party action, FERPA requires us to advise the person we're giving those records to and the court that those records cannot be redisclosed without student or parental consent. Dolores Stafford, speaking in 1998 before Congress, she's a Clery Act expert, about whether student disciplinary records should be open or not, told the story of one student who, while she was attending in university, was sexually assaulted. She did not want to go through a criminal process. She only wanted to use the student code of conduct process because of the privacy protections. The student press went to court. Local judge said those records are not confidential. Story was published, and the consequence was that she dropped out. Campus life professionals have consistently taken the position that that confidentiality is crucial to the process.
So, but ma'am, doesn't redaction solve all those problems?
It can in a particular case. We don't believe it does in this case, where a particular student's records were requested. Their name was ordered erased, essentially, with some other pertinent information. We don't believe that order is a proper redaction. And it isn't just the commissioner's decision or one record that's being requested in this case. It's an entire file with all kinds of documents that are described on pages 3 and 4 of Mr. Krakauer's petition. There's more privacy interest at stake in the records as they were requested, as this case came crafted to this court, than just the named students' records. Most of all, we want to keep student confidentiality in the student code of conduct process and disciplinary records because we want students to come forward and report and seek help. We believe that our Montana legislature values student privacy. That's why they passed Title 20 and 25. Mr. Krakauer does not attack the constitutionality or argue for nullity of the statutes in Title 20, 25. In the absence of a constitutional attack, the commissioner and the MUS are bound by the statutes as valid state law.
He does argue that the statutes cannot trump the constitutional right to know. I guess I interpret that argument as being that he's urging us to construe the statutes in a way that makes them not conflict with the public right to know. Would that be your construction as well?
That's how they've posed the issue in the case, certainly, Justice Baker.
And do you agree with that or not? I mean, what's your take on his argument?
Our argument is that the public's right to know does not trump the statute when you do the balancing test because the importance of keeping those records and that process confidential outweighs the public's right to know.
Counsel, but the statute doesn't support your interpretation because you're not allowing for any exception under any basis for student records. And the statute specifically allows for a mechanism, the subpoena, to provide that balancing. And in that balancing test, the student record, and in the case that you just described, where she did not want to go outside of the university proceedings, that expectation of privacy should be factored in. Maybe the judge was incorrect in that balancing test there. But so I guess, how do you reconcile your interpretation with the exceptions that are specifically provided?
Your Honor, this court can certainly carve out a judicial exception and decide that the public's right to know outweighs the student's privacy interest in this particular case. However, we don't think that it would dictate the release of all the records Mr. Krakauer is asking for. For example, Mr. Krakauer analogizes to the public employee cases, the cases where individuals in positions of public trust had did some egregious violation, the Mayor Whitlock harassing the judge, the police officer in the Bozeman Daily Chronicle case, the teacher in the Anaconda case. But even in those cases where the employees in high positions were disciplined, it is only their name, what they did, and what the punishment was that are released. In a few cases, they are sent back for in-camera review to see if there's anything else that could be released that's been requested, if redactions will protect the complainant and other witnesses in the file. But most of the time, it's just the name, the violation, and the discipline. Here we are talking about students who attend our public universities to get an education. They are not in positions of public trust, earning public salaries, and performing public duties. They are young people beginning their adult lives, and release of their records may have long-standing impact on their future success. Not releasing documents is especially important in cases where there has been no final finding that a serious violation has occurred.
Counsel, let's assume for a minute that we're going to rule against you, and we're going to uphold the decision of the district court here. What would be your hope, then, that would be the procedure after that, involving the documents you're talking about? That we would send it back to the district court for further proceedings, or that...
Perhaps in-camera review?
Your Honor, if this court were to send it back for in-camera review, we would hope there would be an instruction that went along these lines to review the file to see if there's a final decision in it with an adverse finding of a crime of violence or sexual assault. If a final adverse finding is in that file, then proper redactions would have to occur to protect those in that decision, in that document, and have it be released.
In no other documents?
I don't think that students should have less privacy interest in their records than the way you've handled public employee cases, Your Honor.
Good. Counsel, how is FERPA inconsistent, or how are you violating the provisions of FERPA if you do not systematically disclose? In other words, you refuse the production of those documents. There's a subpoena filed, and the court order is issued after a balancing test, and this court perhaps enunciates a rule that provides for a heightened expectation of privacy for students, recognizing all the issues that you've raised. How is that a violation of FERPA?
Your Honor, if we're going to release records that aren't...
It will be pursuant to court order.
Well, if we're going to follow a court order, Justice McKinnon, ordering us to release records that aren't a final decision that's adverse to the student of a particular nature, that would be a violation of FERPA. Now, we could consider, certainly, and would read your order if it has reasons that explain why that are... in more sound than Judge Seeley's decision, then perhaps we would be able to review and comply with that order. We'd have to wait and see, Your Honor.
Well, in fact, you would have to comply with that order, wouldn't you?
We would have to comply with it. I didn't mean that, Your Honor, in terms of not comply. We'd either comply or appeal. It's one or the other, isn't
it? But you're not in violation of FERPA if you're complying with a court order.
Your Honor, if the court order is written in a way that we think, as we do with Judge Seeley's order, that it creates a policy and practice going forward that blows wide open and undermines the restrictions we're under with FERPA.
We're not under those restrictions except in how we interpret the preemption and those issues. You're not systematically disclosing records without, I mean, you would be imposing a policy where records would not be disclosed. It would only be pursuant to court order, which you could not ignore.
Your Honor, if the court issued an order, we review it and certainly, hopefully, be able to comply without having to appeal. It does give us some cover, a court order, if that's what you're asking. But we maintain in this case that the public's right to know doesn't outweigh the student's right to privacy because of the serious policy reasons for why student records should be kept confidential. We don't see any positive purpose in opening up those disciplinary records. And I've got to emphasize that the records that have been requested in this case are not just the named student records. Those files contain quite a number of students' names, and those student names as witnesses and panel members are protected under FERPA. FERPA lays out minimum national baseline standards for student privacy. That's what that law is all about. Now, Mr. Krakauer is a Colorado resident, and we've raised the standing issue with respect to that. We believe the Constitutional Convention folks in discussing Article 9, Article 2, Section 9, talked about Montana citizens and their ability to have access to records.
But, counsel, we don't look to legislative history or, in this case, constitutional history unless there's an ambiguity. And Article 2, Section 9 specifically refers to just a person, not a citizen. I understand that the convention discussed citizens, but isn't the test really in this case just whether Mr. Krakauer has a pulse?
No, Justice Shea, no, I don't think it is. I think the Constitutional Convention folks in Shockley 1, the court did look at the Constitutional Convention notes in informing itself about Article 2, Section 9, and that the court has done that many times in the past, and that what a citizen is and a member of our electorate is defined in 11401 and 402 of our Montana Code, and Mr. Krakauer doesn't meet the definitions in that code.
But, counsel, the good folks at the 1972 Constitutional Convention may have discussed the word citizen versus the word person, but they wrote the word person. They made a conscious decision not to insert the word citizen. So why do we now have to try and reinsert something that they themselves, when they were making those decisions, chose to use the word person rather than citizen?
Your Honor, when we respond as government agents to public record requests, which we do all the time, and try and be as transparent as possible, we are spending taxpayer time and money responding to those requests. That was the theory behind the U.S. Supreme Court decision in McBurney versus Young. And while obviously the standing issue, if you decided that alone in our favor, wouldn't end this litigation, what's important to us here as it relates...
You haven't answered my question. My question is, why would we interpret the word person any differently than the folks who drafted that section of the Constitution when they were debating whether it involved citizen or person, and they chose the word person.
Your Honor,
are you asking us to override and reinterpret what that means?
Justice Sweet, I'm not asking you to override or reinterpret, but what I am saying, I think, is that they were not choosing at the Constitutional Convention between the words citizen and people. They were discussing what that provision would mean when it was applied and enacted. And in those discussions, they talked about it being citizens of Montana, residents of Montana.
So, Ms. Hamill, let me ask you this. Do the 2015 changes to the public records law have any bearing on this case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe House Bill 123 affects this case at all. That the discussions at the hearings when they made those changes were purely about modernizing the language. It was not about any discussion about citizen or person and how broadly that right to know applied. There was nothing in the record about that, Your Honor.
What about the definition of public information, which now talks about confidential information that must be protected against public disclosure under applicable law? That seems new.
Could you read that again, Justice Baker?
So it defines public information to accept EXCEPT, confidential information that must be protected against public disclosure under applicable law.
Yes, Your Honor, and that language was in the definitions prior to the changes in the right to know law, prohibiting disclosures where other laws do so. So I don't think that's really a change.
Counsel, if you could go back to the discussion on standing, and you made in your brief, you argued that the right to know is the right to know what your public bodies, governmental bodies, are doing, and that that right is unique then to Montana citizens. But today, we live in a society where newspaper agencies outside of the state are often useful in monitoring what may be going on within a particular state. For instance, violations in prison, in the area of prison reform. Do we want to discourage that by a narrow interpretation of a person to be citizen? Isn't that useful in terms of monitoring those public bodies as well?
The court, in its wisdom, may decide that it is, Your Honor. The standing issue isn't of all importance to us, obviously, because it's not decisive with respect to the other issues. What is important about Mr. Krakauer's Colorado citizenship is that if he were in his home state of Colorado, he could not get the educational records he is seeking here today. Public institutions in Colorado follow FERPA. FERPA is mentioned no more than 9 times in their law. It's mentioned in Title 22 and 23 of the higher education laws. And I am not suggesting that this court need to follow Colorado laws or look at how Colorado interprets its laws with respect to right to know. But it does speak loudly about why FERPA sets national baseline standards for student privacies. Why should a student, a Montanan, going to a public university in Colorado have greater privacy rights than a student going to a public university in Montana? The same is true in Ohio, Vermont, North Carolina, California, Indiana, Iowa, and Washington, D.C. Educational records and records of a student code of conduct process are protected. Sometimes public records requests can be fulfilled, Your Honor, because we can get consent. Sometimes we can deliver aggregate information that's responsive to a request. Sometimes we can't. And we think that's because of our Montana privacy statutes, standing alone, and FERPA. We think if this court, and we urge this court, to harmonize FERPA with its 16 exceptions with our Montana student privacy law, working together, we can navigate and be able to respond and know how to respond to future student records requests.
Well, counsel, isn't that what Judge Seeley did? You just happen to disagree with her. You think she went too far, don't you?
I do, Your Honor. I don't think she did the balancing test. I don't think she didn't do an in-camera review. She didn't take into consideration fully what our Montana student privacy statutes say, and she didn't take fully into consideration FERPA. With that, I see I have 1 minute left, and I'd like to reserve that for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. I'm Mike Malloy. I represent the appellee in this case, John Krakauer. I brought this.
Mr. Malloy, before you launch into your entertaining argument here, I have a question for you.
Sure.
you heard Ms. Hamill respond to my question about, well, if we decided to rule against the university system in this case and remand the case back for potentially an in-camera review, how would you respond to that?
Well, I don't like in-camera reviews because I represent people who are trying to access documents. And
we understand you don't like them, but we've had a series of cases that talk about that. Let's talk about that.
An in-camera review is normally part of the process, but it benefits the custodian of the document because the custodian knows what's in the document, and when they're submitted to the court, the custodian is in a much better position than the requester to know whether or not there's something in the document that bears on the constitutional balancing test. I have no idea.
But that's why you have an in-camera review, because you take it from the custodian and an independent judge looks at it and then does the balancing test.
Yes, but
what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it is the requester has no idea what's in it, and it puts them at a disadvantage to make whatever argument they want to make about the contents and whether there's some invasion of privacy. And so I don't like them. I know that's part of the process. It didn't occur in this case. I have no idea why. I think Judge Seeley was wondering as well, because she sits in Helena and gets requests for documents, petitions filed more often than most judges, and she usually gets that.
Well, Ms. Hamill suggested that you suggested to the judge that we don't need to do that, Judge. Let's just move along here.
I didn't think we needed to do it because I thought I could make my case without an in-camera review, but I never have an objection to it.
But counsel, those documents are student records, and they're confidential. Why should you have the right to look at those documents right off the bat? They're confidential to begin with.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I agree with you that the petitioner ought not to be able to review the documents at the same time as the court. But I'm just trying to explain that it puts the petitioner at a serious disadvantage.
Well, now we have a situation where you've got an obviously frustrated court because we don't know what we're talking about. I mean, we don't have anything in the record. We don't have an in-camera review. Ms. Hamill says we're talking about boxes of documents, you know, a plethora of student names and student complaints and privacy issues, and we don't know. We don't know what we have.
Well, with all due respect, Chief Justice McGrath, I don't think you need to know that. I don't think there's anything in those records that's going to help you decide the legal issues in this case. And the legal issue in this case is whether FERPA bans the disclosure of the records of the university and the commissioner's handling of Jordan Johnson's disciplinary process.
Counsel, what about beyond Mr. Johnson? What about, as Ms. Hamill alluded to, what about the privacy interests of the other students who are involved, including the complainant herself?
Judge Seeley ordered that all of those names be redacted, and we have no problem with that. We're not interested.
Well, except for the fact that part of your argument about why the Mr. Johnson's privacy rights are waived is because of the publicity that surrounded this whole event. And in your own brief, you noted that the trial was extensively covered by state and local media, and both he and the victim testified in open court. So to a great extent, and as a matter of fact, Mr. Krakauer was able to ascertain, according to him and according to you, that the disciplinary records that were released by Judge Christensen were Mr. Johnson's, despite the redactions, because of the similarities. And you've made the determination that in the letter from Bargava Jackson letter, that there was a reference to Commissioner Christian's determination and his changing of the burden of proof based on the knowledge that's already out there. So does the redaction really serve any purpose as it would pertain to the complainant or any other student?
No, it does, because it redacts the name of any other student, it redacts the name of anybody that sat on the university court, it redacts the name of witnesses. We have no problem with that. But in order to obtain access to those documents under the constitutional balancing test, we have to be able to argue that the demands of individual privacy of Jordan Johnson in these records does not clearly outweigh the merits of public disclosure. So as far as Jordan Johnson is concerned, it's important for us to know the name of that person, because we have to make our argument here about whether or not there's an actual or subjective expectation of privacy in those records by Mr. Johnson.
So are you saying that the complainant's expectation of privacy is abrogated by the redaction?
No, I'm not saying that. You mean the complainants, you mean
The woman who accused Mr. Johnson.
Oh, yes, I think that name should be redacted.
And you're saying, though, that satisfies her expectation of privacy. Do we know even what her feelings are about the release of these documents?
If you redact her name, there's no identity of the woman involved. So
that goes back to the point that you argue yourself in saying that the privacy, Mr. Johnson's privacy interests, have essentially been abrogated by noting that both he and the complainant testified in open court in a highly publicized trial. So does the redaction really serve a purpose?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I know that during the phase of the criminal trial, the media could have reported the name of the victim. They decided not to, so there really hasn't been any public disclosure of the name of the victim today. And in Mr. Krakauer's book, he uses a pseudonym. So her privacy rights will be protected if you redact her name, because it won't show up in any of the records. And we're happy to take that record with her name redacted.
So humor me a little bit. Kind of walk me through what it is that he wants. He doesn't want the names. Do you want to know what the process is, what was considered by the commissioner, how they considered that, or...
And what they did when it was sent back to the university. We don't care about we don't care about the behavior of Jordan Johnson. We care about the behavior of the Commissioner of Higher Education and the Dean of Students who reinstated him. Well, how do I know he was reinstated? Because he was back throwing a football in the fall.
Right. So you're trying to find out in this particular case what processes were followed by the commissioner's office and what they did to make their decision.
Yes, Your Honor, we are. That's what we're looking for.
Okay.
And that's why the names of people in those documents is not really relevant to our request.
So, counsel, to follow up on that, then, you don't really need the boxes of documents. You just need what was delivered to the commissioner and what he did after that point.
And what the University of Montana did
after he
sent it back, yes. Okay. That's what we're looking
for. So your request for documents can be encapsulated at least in some kind of a timeline here.
Yes.
Okay. And in that timeline, you don't care if the names are redacted.
We don't care.
You just want to look at the process and see how they, what they relied on, the criteria they relied on to make their decisions.
It's our position on the balancing test that not only do we deserve to know that under the constitutional guarantee, but the public is entitled to know that in this particular case.
Well, let's turn to the balancing test, because you've mentioned that a couple of times, and I'd like to talk about the resolution of the legal issue. I asked Ms. Hamel about the difference between the balancing test that I see as being applied in FERPA cases and the balancing test that we typically apply under our Constitution, where under our Constitution, the right to privacy may only be infringed by the showing of a compelling state interest. And under the FERPA test, the party seeking disclosure must show a genuine need for the information that outweighs the student's privacy rights. So I'd like to hear you talk about how those balancing tests either do or do not conflict. And in this particular case, when applied, what compelling interest does the state have in turning over documents that are private under state law to one private individual for commercial use?
Whoa, let's see. Let me answer the last question.
But I had to get it out to get a word in edgewise up here.
It usually doesn't happen.
Justice Baker, I've not noticed that you've had any trouble getting words in edgewise. I think that because the operative provision of FERPA only applies to the university's policy and practice and only causes them jeopardy when they engage in a systematic disclosure of records, I do not think that a case-by-case analysis under the Montana Constitution constitutes a pattern and practice, and this court has ruled so in the Pioneer Press case. So the proper balancing test is not under FERPA. It's under the jurisprudence that you have developed in the past since 1972, governing how the right to know works and how we protect privacy in connection with that in connection with that provision. And so the proper balancing test is whether the demands of individual privacy clearly exceed the merits of public disclosure. That's the proper balancing test, and that's the balancing test that we argued in the district court, and that's the balancing test that Judge Seeley applied.
Counsels, but would you impose within that balancing test some extra protection or recognition of a student's records, a heightened expectation of privacy, if for no other reason that you have the protections provided by FERPA?
No, I would not.
And why not?
Because this court has clearly stated in the Pioneer Press case that FERPA only applies to the policies of the university. It does not affect, let me read to you, it does not reflect the systematic, it does not reflect it does not affect the constitutional obligations of people to provide documents under the Constitution, nor does it affect the court's ability to resolve those issues. So I don't think FERPA adds anything to the process. They can be harmonized.
You don't think a student has an expectation of privacy in their disciplinary records or in their records that is above an expectation of privacy of a public official or employee?
I don't think that a student has a greater expectation of privacy in their records than a taxpayer has in their records. The Constitution doesn't differentiate between students or taxpayers.
But we allow a balancing of interests.
We do.
And isn't that part of the interest to be considered?
That they're a student?
Yes.
No, I don't think it should be.
Well, counsel, after we decided Pioneer Press, which you advocate today, we should apply. the federal government responded by adopting a new regulation under FERPA that seemed to increase the interest of students in their records by saying, school authorities, you can't release those records if you even reasonably suspect that the recipient will know the identity of the student. Doesn't that up the bar in terms of the student privacy interest?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. And you will recall when Pioneer Press was argued, one of the primary arguments made by the Cut Bank schools was that because Leanne Cavanaugh, the reporter, knew who the disciplined students were, release of redacted records would disclose the identity of the students. So they argued that you couldn't do that because she knew who they were. And that's the targeted request rule that they're asserting somehow changes the meaning of Pioneer Press. You rejected that argument. You rejected that argument saying that such revelations, and that's that you were referring to her knowledge outside of the identity of the students, do not factor into the constitutional balancing test nor mitigate the government's constitutional obligations. And I'm quoting from paragraph 37 of Pioneer Press. And so contrary to the commissioner's argument that this targeted request rule somehow changes things, it doesn't change the operative provision of FERPA, which only applies to a systematic policy or practice of releasing student records.
How does the university deal with that? I mean, how does the university implement that particular provision if it has no meaning? How do they respond to it?
Well,
somehow
I think
under our law, it doesn't matter.
No, I think they should be following the Montana Constitution. So if there is a request for documents of a student, they decide whether or not there's an expectation of privacy, and I can assure you they will say because of FERPA or because of Title 20, there is an expectation of privacy, and then balance that to determine whether or not that expectation of privacy clearly exceeds the merits of public disclosure. And in 99% of the cases, they're going to say, can't disclose it. That's what they should be doing. That's what we expect them to do.
Well, counsel, in assessing the merits of public disclosure, though, if, as you say, the only thing Mr. Krakauer is really interested in is the process that happened after it went to Commissioner Christian, what do you expect to find in the documents that you're seeking that's not already summarized at page 17 of the Bargava-Jackson letter?
Well,
which you already have.
We do, but we're talking about a decision of the university court to expel him, a decision of the president of the University of Montana to expel him, and then the commissioner gets it and sends it back. We don't know why.
Well, except for you represent that you do know why, because the Bargava-Jackson letter summarizes it, and you say in your brief that is unquestionably the dealing with the Jordan Johnson case.
Yeah,
so that's the process. You know what the process is.
I know that it was sent back, and I know that he was reinstated because of the Bargava letter.
So what are the merits of public disclosure?
I don't know why. And I would like to know, and Mr. Krakauer would like to know, and I think the public deserves to know, why was he reinstated? And those documents will reflect that.
But isn't that also, the why is also summarized in the Jackson letter?
The Bargava letter doesn't explain why. What the Bargava letter does is say, if it was sent back and a different burden of proof was imposed, that it might be violating Title IX. Because if you apply a clear and convincing evidence standard, it makes it much more difficult to deal with rapes on campus. And that's why the preponderance of the evidence standard was submitted in the Dear Colleague letter. So she's saying in there, this doesn't make any sense, and it's inconsistent with Title IX. But she doesn't say why, and we don't know why. And that's why we need the records. And that's why the public should know this this, why, what the rationale behind this decision was.
And that's why CutBank, our opinion in CutBank Press allowed the release of those records.
Yes.
But it was pursuant to that balancing.
Yes, yes. And if
you now have the CFR, which says if we know what who that person is, then we can't disclose.
Yes, but that CFR regulation does not affect the operative provision of FERPA, which is only to cause problems for the university if they engage in a pattern and practice. And Justice Rice's opinion in the Pioneer Press case makes it very clear that the two can fit together and that we decide under the Constitution, and if we do on a case-by-case basis decide that the records should be released, it doesn't constitute a problem for FERPA. And that's what Judge Seeley found below.
They can fit together, but the federal government has now made the students' records a higher privacy right than they were at the time we decided Pioneer Press.
This was a congressional act, so the Department of Education can't change the operative provision, but it still has to fit within the operative provision. So even if the requester knows the identity of the student, disclosure of those records does not, on a case-by-case basis, doesn't constitute a pattern or practice. So it doesn't make any difference in the big analysis whether or not the requester knows the name of the student. And it doesn't make any sense to do that in Montana, particularly where in order for there to be a determination about the right of privacy versus the merits of public disclosure, you have to know whether or not the person in question had an actual or subjective right of privacy. So you have to know all the circumstances surrounding
We try not to inquire into the common sense of federal regulation.
Yes, I understand that. I don't blame you.
Counsel, can you address the argument you make in your brief about Jordan Johnson having a reduced expectation of privacy because he plays sports?
Yes.
And how do we draw the line between D1 sports, D2, D3, NAIA? Where does it stop?
Well, I don't think you need to get to that question because all of the things that caused him problems for his enrollment at the University of Montana have been fully disclosed and publicized not only in Montana but across the nation. So there isn't any privacy yet to protect. But what I was suggesting in my argument is that when a student athlete signs that code of conduct, they acknowledge that they, because they participate in intercollegiate sports, and in this case, in some categories, these are D1 sports. They're all D1 sports. Some of them are not, but they're all D1. Some of them are D1 sports. Some aren't. When they do that, they're subjected to pretty intense public scrutiny. That is, the press covers them. When they do a good job, they get good publicity. When they do a bad job, they get dissed. And they have to expect that that's going to happen. And they have to acknowledge that they are losing some rights when they become a student athlete because of that scrutiny. So my argument would be that if this were not Jordan Johnson, the star quarterback whose publicity has exceeded all bounds in this case,
be careful.
if it were a bobcat.
You're really treading on thin ice.
I know. I have to tell you why I brought this hat.
I don't care why you brought that hat.
Oh, you don't care?
No.
Okay. That's because you're a bobcat. No. The acknowledgement of this publicity is something that student athletes have to deal with, and it will vary depending upon how much notoriety a particular athlete gets. And there is a diminished right of privacy. It may or may not, probably most of the time, won't clearly exceed the merits of public disclosure, depending upon, you know, what the issue is.
Which is part of the factoring in that balancing
yes.
test.
Yes. Sorry, that was a very easy question.
Thank you.
I should have answered it that way. How am I doing? 7 minutes.
So, Mr. Malloy, I have a question. Yes. What about Section 25-25-515? I mean, that statute requires there either be consent of the student or a subpoena. And everybody kind of glosses over that. I mean, it seems like in the arguments the parties gloss over that requirement, but there wasn't a subpoena issued in this case. Is it your position that statute is unconstitutional, that it conflicts with the right of privacy under the Constitution?
It could, based on how it was applied. I do not think the legislature can pass a law that supplants the constitutional right to know provision. So my analysis, both below and up here, has been on the constitutional Article 2, Section 9. That's what I've been arguing. And I haven't spent any time arguing about Title 20 because I don't think this court would say that somehow Title 20 trumps the constitutional provision. So I can't remember now, and I'm.
Well, in this regard, I mean, it's just the statute just sets up a process. I mean, it's not. It says if you want records, then here's what you need. You either need consent or you need to get a subpoena.
Well, you have established a process for getting records that you declared back in 1976 about how a person who wants records should get them under the Constitution, and that's, I think, the proper analysis, okay. And that's what we've been pursuing, not Title 20.
Counsel, can you address in your remaining minutes the issue of standing on the enabling legislation, specifically allowing for the right to be exercised by a Montana citizen?
Well, I frankly was surprised that counsel made that argument in the district court, because if you apply simple rules of statutory construction and take the words at their common meaning, a person who wants records is entitled to the guarantees of the Constitution, and it's not limited in any way to the residents of Montana, and I don't think there's any way that could be construed in any other way than to say, if you're a person, you have standing to pursue the case. And what seemed to be odd to me about the argument is that the university seemed to be giving Jordan Johnson, who came from Oregon, I don't know whether he was a resident or non-resident, but protecting his privacy and at the same time suggesting that Mr. Krakauer comes from Colorado, didn't have standing to request a document under the same constitutional provision. So I don't think there's any question that when looking at the word person, that it does not exclude anybody from out of state.
The preamble of the Constitution says persons of Montana.
Oh, man. Well, I don't think that it could be successfully maintained that, as I think you asked the question, people from out of state who have an interest in things in Montana, and in this case, the interest in the way the university dealt with rape on campus is not just a local issue, it's a nationwide issue. Mr. Krakauer is the messenger of all of this, and to say that he can't get information from public officials because he's from Colorado just makes no sense, and it's not consistent with the statutory construction analysis that the district court engaged in.
Well, but counsel, what about the notion, just in terms of conducting the balancing test, when we're talking about the right to privacy requires the demonstration of a compelling state interest, and Mr. Krakauer, irrespective of his residency, is a private individual. He's an author writing a book for profit, as opposed to, say, an advocacy group for against sexual violence coming forward seeking this information. I mean, in terms of demonstrating the compelling state interest and assessing the merits of the public disclosure, doesn't that factor in?
No, because the Constitution, as it relates to access to records or meetings, does not have a compelling interest component. It balances the right of privacy by with respect to those kinds of inquiries with the right to know in Article 2, Section 9, not in Article 2, Section 10.
But what are the merits of public disclosure under Article 2, Section 10, when we're talking about a private individual writing a book as opposed to, like I said, an advocacy group who is seeking to... What's the public interest?
Well,
this particular request?
No one has argued that we should use any standard under Article 10, because you have made it clear that if it's a request for a document, you use Title 9 or Article 9, Article 2, Section 9. That's what you've said. That's what the analysis, the compelling interest standard doesn't even apply.
No, I know. I'm talking about the merits of public disclosure, which is under Article 2, Section 9. Well, and is there a distinction? Are the merits higher when it is, as an example, an advocacy group? Is there more merit to the disclosure when it's being requested by an advocacy group against sexual violence as opposed to a private author who's writing a book?
No, I don't think the Constitution, which uses the word person, distinguishes between somebody that's more interested than not, because if you start doing that, then if you're the custodian of the document, you're going to start asking, well, what's your interest? And under the Montana Constitution, as you have written it, the government is not entitled to know why. The government has an obligation to permit an examination by any person. And it doesn't make any difference why they're asking for it. And you've made that real clear in all of your jurisprudence in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Muller.
Am I done?
You're done.
Yes. But what? Put your hat on and sit down.
I wanted to remind all of the alums of the University of Montana what their motto is, which is lux et veritas, which is light and truth. And it is that what we are here arguing, and we hope that you shed some light and truth on this decision. Thank you.
Ms. Hamill.
Your Honors, and I'm told by the clerk I have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Malloy has said they want to know about the process. The process is available in the Code of Conduct policy, in the Board of Regents policy, that states that the decisions can be appealed all the way up through the President, to the Commissioner, to the Board of Regents, and back down again.
Well, Ms. Hamill, that's not what he's saying. Is he wants to know why, when it finally reached the Commissioner's desk, was it Jordan Johnson, his whatever was decided below, was overturned and it was sent back and he was reinstated? That's what they want to know.
I understand, Your Honor. And they are asking for the entire record. And it is the record in any case.
Well, wait a minute. I asked him, I said, okay, so we have this timeline parameter between when it arrived on the commissioner's desk and the commissioner made a decision to overturn and it went back. That's the timeline parameter that we're dealing with. So those are the documents. Do you have a problem with that?
I do, Your Honor, because that is a lot of documents.
Okay, so the size of the documents is going to dictate how we decide our case?
No, Your Honor, but I do think that there would need to be an in-camera review to see what documents would explain what the commissioner decided. And okay, Perhaps that is just a singular document. We won't know until a court advises us on that.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, Mr. Malloy is speculating. He's speculating what happened below, and he's speculating about what's in the Bergara-Jackson letter. There are many cases discussed in that Bergara-Jackson letter, and they're all redacted. With respect to the athletic code, 2025-512 specifically prohibits the university from entering into a contract that waives a student right to privacy. The athletic code is merely aspirational. That's all it is. Athletes, no matter what sport they're in, don't lose their privacy rights by enrolling in the Montana University system. Laws are sometimes trump the right to know. This court decided that as recently in the Elliott versus Department of Revenue case. Mr. Malloy talked about the Cutbank case. In the Cutbank case, there was no need to reach a decision under FERPA. It was a very limited request, Your Honor. This case is not a win-lose for the university system. We need your guidance about what Montana student privacy statutes and student privacy laws mean, as well as FERPA, with respect to this particular situation and going forward with future records requests. That's what we're asking for, Your Honor, as well as a complete reversal of Judge Seeley's decision. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to both counsel. This matter is now concluded. The court will take it under advisement, and we will issue an opinion in due course. Court's adjourned.